Hello, my name is Fliss Gorst. Welcome to Journeys in Jazz, the podcast that explores why jazz is still popular amongst listeners and performers today. In this episode, I am delighted to present to you an interview of highly celebrated jazz bassist Arnie Somerji. Arnie is a musician in demand. He's been in countless jazz ensembles and has performed on over 60 albums. As a band leader, he's made a few himself too, which we talk about later on. We also discuss his musical progression from learning violin as a child to working for 13 weeks at Ronnie Scott's in his first year out of music college. Arnie teaches bass on the jazz degree course at Birmingham Conservatoire, which is actually where I met him years ago. Interestingly, he mentions why he thinks jazz courses work and how it's important to look for potential as well as ability in new students. We also mention his Hungarian heritage and his family's migration to the UK. Arnie has a slight tendency to embellish the occasional story in a very entertaining way. I'll let you decide which bits you think he might have been creative with. So, without further ado, it's time to settle down with Arnie and his cup of tea. Here he is. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
It's very nice
to be here.
How's your tea?
Well, it's warm. It's very wet. I can't work out what the taste is because this is one of the teas that we just bought in a Bulgarian shop around the corner, and we have no idea what's in the tea bag, but we'll find out soon enough, I think, Fliss.
You know. I don't think we will we? How will we?
I'm going to get the box. That's a start. Hold on. Oh, I think I can tell you what's in this now. So it's mainly rose hips, but there is a herb.
Thyme.
Yes, correct. Wild thyme. That brings me onto the jazz thing, you know, because thyme is a essential part of the music, and carry on.
Now I feel like I'm talking to jazz legend Mike Williams, but I'm not.
This interview isn't about him.
It's about who?
It's about me.
It's not about Bulgarian tea.
No, but it's a good place to start, you see, because it's already broken the ice.
But you're not from Bulgaria.
No. I was born in Birmingham, but my father was Hungarian. He still is Hungarian. Well, he lives in the UK now. So my ancestry is Hungarian. First generation immigrant.
Mm.
Yeah, so...
So when you were growing up, who was introducing you to music? Was it both of your parents?
Well, I grew up with my dad, so... Yeah, but yeah. My mum always had good musical taste as well, but she's more into the kind of... She's more into the sort of pop thing, you know. I played violin from the age of 5. I think violin is a really bad thing to start kids on, actually.
Why?
It's a bad instrument.
Because it's hard to sound good.
Because it's hard to sound good on it, yeah.
Results are slow.
Yeah, they are.
And children want things quickly.
Yeah, and they want, you know, it's good to have that kind of instant thing.
Mm.
So I would suggest piano. Piano's good because you just do that.
It's right there, isn't it?
I'm gesticulating with my hands at the moment.
You are.
What else is good? Probably the stuff that you can make a noise out of and it sounds good straight away. So piano, drums, maybe? No.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
Recorder,
better than violin. I remember having violin lessons at school. We weren't actually given a violin. We were given two bits of wood, and one was the bow, and the other bit was the violin, and we just had to do that.
So you just got the movement?
Just got the movement, yeah, that was part of the thing.
Oh, gosh, was that really boring?
Well, what do you think?
Yes. How old were you?
That's when I was 3 years old. No, I can't remember it, but it was at primary school. Unless I'm imagining this.
I don't think so.
No, I think we started like that and then we moved on to actually having violins.
Okay, so that was the first step and then you got a violin.
Got a violin.
And how many people were you learning with?
Well, it was a group. In those days, anyone who wanted to learn could learn. So
oh,
I think
nice.
It was probably maybe 12 of us or something like that.
And which part of Birmingham was this?
No, this was in Northampton. That's where I grew up. I was born in Birmingham, but I escaped along the Grand Union Canal.
Did you really?
In a submarine, yes. Yeah.
That's, nicely done.
The family that we built our own submarine and managed to escape from Birmingham along the Grand Union Canal.
It's pretty stealth, isn't it?
It was easy to do in those days because in those days you didn't have the what they call the U-boats, submarine destroyers, cruising the canals in those days. It was mainly fishermen.
After the days of the Peaky Blinders.
Yes, exactly.
So
we escaped in a submarine and then ended up in Northampton.
You didn't pick a more exotic location. You just
well, as far as we could
do.
Get.
Right.
It's quite slow work, you know, going out, especially with the locks and things. It took about 3 years to get that far. So.
By which time you needed to learn the violin and get going.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
I get the feeling you don't believe my life story.
I'm accepting of it, because you have to be these days, don't you? You know. But
you can't get away with any old shit.
I'm considering what the real one might be. And
real what?
Your real life.
Now, my real life? No, okay. Well, I was born in Birmingham, but my family lived in Coventry, my mum and dad and me. And then we moved to Northampton, where my dad opened his first practice.
Practice as a...
As a... As a
don't
as a,
make it up.
As a mime artist. As a comedian. No, as a dentist. He's still... He was practicing till he retired.
Wow. A reliable job.
He had a reliable job. You see, the interesting thing is, because my family came out of Hungary with nothing.
Right.
We came out with nothing. Not enough, nothing, mate. You know, they only came out with...
They didn't talk like that either.
No, they didn't. No, they came out... But they only came out with their clothes. Lucky they came out with those. Otherwise, it might have been a whole different scenario. But they had clothes. But they had very little. The reason they ended up in Northampton, which is where my dad went to school when he arrived in the UK, was because my grandfather was a solicitor. In Hungary, in order to practice as a solicitor in the UK, he had to retake all his exams. And he put an advert in the Legal Gazette, and the only person that got back to him was a solicitor for a pupillage, which is where you train.
Uh-huh.
And the only person who got back to him was a solicitor in Northampton, so they ended up there. And my father was, he used to enjoy playing the piano, and I think he was pretty good actually. And my mum told me that he probably would have wanted to pursue a career in music, but because there was pressure on him to get a regular job, he ended up training as a dentist.
And this is all quite a few years before you were born?
Not that long before I was born, because my dad became a father at 24, and I'm the oldest of the two of us, my brother and me. But I think that was not unusual in those days, early 20s, to have kids. The whole family left in 1956. Mm. There was the Hungarian uprising, which was like a revolution.
Yeah.
And they lived through the war. They came out during the war to England, actually, because my grandmother was English. She lived in Hungary. And then they went back after the war, and then it all started again, so they left. Mm. So they came over in 1956. And in those days, refugees were much more welcome. They were given a council house. I think Northampton Council allocated two council houses for Hungarian refugees, and they got one of them. So they ended up there. And then my dad went to study dentistry at Birmingham, where he met my mum, who was studying nursing. And then shortly after that, he took a course in submarine captaincy to get us out down the canal, you know.
He did very well at that successful.
He was a very, very, very well-renowned...
Submariner.
Submariner, yes. That's what he was, yeah. Anyway. Yeah, coming back to the childhood musical thing, actually telling you the truth for a change. Music was always part of the house. There was always music going on. My brother and I both played instruments. My cousins played instruments.
It was a thing that you did then?
It was a thing. We had a little band together.
Did you?
Yeah, a little band. You know, I played bass, my brother played keyboard and saxophone. Ooh. My cousin played guitar and my other cousin sang. So there was a little band going on.
Was that a thing for family occasions? And
yeah, we used to put on little plays and productions, you know, for...
Did you earn a lot of money out of it?
No. They didn't give us anything. I was very mean. But we did have a little band when I was 14. I was working in a band with my cousin. And we used to do little gigs in pubs as a kind of novelty act. Because we were so young. Yes, so that was there. That was what was going on.
How did you start learning to play bass? Because you were playing the violin.
Yes, but then it was one of those situations where nobody else wanted to play it.
Okay, so that's what a lot of double bass players say.
Well, like, in the band.
How they begin playing the bass.
That's interesting, isn't it? Mm. When we put our little band together, this was a band with George Stevens, my friend Michael, who was my cousin. They both wanted to play guitar, and nobody wanted to play the bass, so I got lumbered with the bass. It was fine, actually. I quite enjoyed it. So I had a go on that, and I thought, yeah, it's quite nice. This easy.
Whose bass was it?
It must have been one of Michael's things. Yeah, my auntie's house, where his mum, she was quite bohemian, so there were lots of musicians hanging out. So there was probably I think it was probably his bass, Michael's bass, that I must have used.
Were you listening to jazz at that time?
No, I wasn't listening to jazz. I did, but I didn't know I was listening to jazz. That's the interesting thing, because my grandmother, she was a big Fats Waller fan. She used to play a record called Your Feet's Too Big, and we used to do a little dance to that. Four cousins. She used to play kind of like stride piano as well. It was kind of interesting. And she was into Oscar Peterson too. And then my dad had a few jazz records, nothing much. You know, he had Dave Brubeck Take 5 and a couple of Oscar Peterson, Thelonious Monk Underground and a few records like that.
Enough to...
Yes, enough to dabble.
Interest.
Dabble, yeah. I think. Yes, dabble. Yeah. But when I first started playing the jazz music, because the band with the cousins was, that was a covers band. When I finished school at the age of 18, I used to go and play gigs with a local trad band in Northampton on bass guitar. It was probably terrible.
On bass guitar?
I'm sure it was awful. I didn't know.
Why not double bass?
I didn't have one at that point.
Right.
Double bass came later.
So you were playing electric bass?
Yes.
Okay.
My first professional gig was with another covers band, and we went to Germany, and it was called Private Life, the name of the band.
Ooh.
Ooh, sounds saucy, doesn't saucy. It? Saucy. Saucy Private Life. And that was playing in American air bases in Germany,
uh-huh.
mainly. We recorded for an agent, and then he got us gigs, and we were doing sort of pop covers at the time. We got sacked. Well, the agent sort of basically told us there was no more work for us because we were... They'd had complaints about us being crap.
I can't believe that.
Well, I think they were probably right, actually. It was a
How
bit,
old were
it
you
was
at
a
this
bit
point?
Ropey. That was between school and university, so I would have been 18. So that was in... I had a year off.
And then you studied?
I studied English at Bristol University, where I became a member of the Bristol University Jazz Band. Again, I was playing electric bass, and I thought, oh, I better get a double bass now, so...
And did that feel like a huge move?
No.
No.
No, it was just... I like the look of them, really. That was the thing. So I got... I bought one of those with my first grant check.
Was it hard? Oh, wow.
Was it hard?
Was it hard?
Buying it? No, it was easy. I just went and gave the guy some money and he gave me the bass. It was really easy.
And then you had to pay your rent.
And that, yeah, but, you know, I just kind of racked up my overdraft. And
was it a hard transition or not?
It's a very different instrument, yeah. So yeah. It took a bit of work. I didn't really take it seriously until I left. Maybe when I was in the sort of second or third year at university, then I started getting lessons, private lessons from a bass player. Paul Anstey was his name, and he was a very good teacher. He basically referred me back to the Simandl method, which is the one that he used to learn the bass. It's standard fingering, you know.
So what does Simandl mean?
Well, Simandl is a set of bass studies, and it's a system. So he took me through those exercises, even though he was a jazz player, and I'm very glad he did that because it helped me develop a decent technique.
But you were still doing it for fun, as it were.
I was doing it for fun.
Yeah.
I've always done it for fun.
Yeah, well, those are...
Yeah.
It's not a bad reason.
Well, it's the only reason at the end of the day, isn't it? Yeah, I think I did the wrong course, actually, at university. I did enjoy some of it, but a lot of it was very traditional, and I think I would have been better off with a more modern English course. I remember reading Old English for the first time. It looks like German. You can't read it at all, you know, it's like... What does this mean? Nobody knows. Yeah, so the bass playing was on the side, really, and then I got my degree, and I went to do one of those Abertold summer schools at Goldsmiths College. I ended up in a band where Jean Toussaint was teaching. He was the coach in that band. You know, he was probably only in his...
He can't have been...
No, I think he was probably...
A lot older than you.
Well, he's... I think he's in his 60s now, isn't he? So
is he?
He's maybe 10 years older than me, maybe a bit less.
That had an impact,
yeah, it was
I
good.
Imagine.
Yeah, it was good. And he said, yes, I was going to do a Jean Toussaint impression then, but I better not.
I want to hear it.
I can't do it.
Okay.
He was teaching at the Guildhall then.
Yeah.
And that was the only jazz course at the time. It was like a postgrad diploma course at the Guildhall. We were just talking about that, and I said, oh, well, you teach there, yeah. I've often thought about doing something like that. He said, you get in if you auditioned. And then I said, would I? And he said, yeah. And so I auditioned and got in, and that's what got me up to London.
Was that a shock to you when you got in?
It was a bit of a shock, yeah. Well, it was a surprise. It wasn't a shock. It wasn't...
A nice surprise.
It was a nice surprise, yes. A nice surprise for us.
And how did Bristol compare to London? Or London compared to Bristol, I guess?
Well, the Bristol scene was... It's a good scene, you know. I think it's probably got better, actually, over the years. The jazz scene is probably better developed in London. Well, it certainly is. Bristol's got a good music scene, you know. There's some great bands that have come out there. Bands like Portishead and Massive Attack and...
Definitely.
Bands like that. And in fact... Yeah. Portishead, you say there's a connection with Portishead because my mate Adrian Utley, I first met in Northampton actually because he used to live in Northamptonshire. He was in a band in Bristol and he'd moved down to the West Country. I met him again down there and we started doing gigs, jazz gigs. And then he went on to do this thing, Portishead, you know, which became a massive thing. And I ended up playing standards at jazz functions. I followed a different path, you know. I sort of did the straight ahead jazz thing. So
you could have been in Portishead.
I could have if I'd stayed there, you know, maybe. Oh well, it doesn't matter, does it? I've no regrets.
When you moved to London, was it overwhelming? Were you nervous?
No, not at all. Was it just... No, it was... Easy. Well, I was already working up there, you see.
Yeah.
I was playing with a guy called Tommy Chase, who was a part of the acid jazz, sort of jazz revival thing in the late 80s. Playing gigs like the 100 Club and the Wag Club at the time. He was mad. He was mad, completely mad.
In what way?
In kind of all sorts of ways. Well, he had this thing going, it was like a bebop-y thing, but it was like really, really loud, like sort of rock band volume levels.
Right.
It was all quite fast and shuffly, and there were people would dance to it, though, you know. It was quite an interesting time. I used to do these jazz all-nighters at the 100 Club, where there'd be a couple of DJs and then a live band in the middle.
Yeah.
There would be people of my age, and at that time I was early 20s, dancing to bebop. It was mad. It was good.
That's quite something for the late 80s,
yeah,
isn't
wish,
it?
Yeah, I thought that was going to. I thought that's what it was going to be like all the time.
Yeah. And it's not because people knit at your gigs now.
You saw that, yes. The knitting. I had to take it out. I got into trouble.
Well, it happens to the best of us.
Yeah, exactly. Knitting. I heard you had had a puzzle booker at yours.
And a knitter.
A knitter and a puzzle booker.
Yeah.
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 At the same gig.
Yeah.
That must have been very...
My mum was the one that clocked them. I didn't.
Right, okay.
She was the one knitting that... No, she wasn't. She wasn't. No. She was all right. She was just... It what was just she, interesting.
What did she say? Did she say anything to them?
No.
Did she challenge them at all?
No. I understand it. I can see how it's like... Listening to jazz, especially if you're getting dragged along. You don't really want to be there. Or if you're there, but...
You're not really
it's
sure.
It's just an exercise in mindfulness and relaxation.
Knitting.
Maybe.
Yeah, I think so.
And
I think
so
it could be, couldn't it?
Combined
do something with your hands.
With listening to jazz is quite a nice thing.
Let's try now. Get out the needles.
I haven't got any needles here. Yeah, no, I do understand it. It's like people that go to the Albert Hall when the proms are on and sit in the gallery.
Yeah.
And they do all kinds of things up there.
I bet. I can't imagine what, but knitting maybe.
Well, the
macrame.
Yeah, they just do whatever they want.
Origami?
They lie down, they go to sleep, they do some origami.
Yes, oregano.
It's not the 100 Club.
No, it's not the 100 Club.
In 1989.
No, 1989.
I'm still thinking about the fact that you were studying in London. Suddenly, you were playing with a...
It was amazing
people.
Mate, yeah, I was very lucky actually, because when I came out of the Guildhall in 1990 there were very few bass players in London that could play or would play or wanted to play time, you know, solid time. It was kind of a lot of busy stuff going on,
and you were happy to
I was always obsessed with sound as well and trying to emulate as closely as I could the acoustic sound of the instrument.
Yeah,
whereas at the time I think we were just coming out of the trend of very heavily amplified, low-action bass playing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you imagine Ron Carter's 80s sound
mm-hmm.
or Gary Peacock's kind of 80s sound, you know, very different sound to the sound of Paul Chambers or Ray Brown, which is a sound that I always loved. So I was always experimenting with strings and pickups and kind of got to a point where I think I was kind of fairly close to that sound. And then coming out of the Guildhall at that time, there weren't very many bass players that could play good time in London. So I just worked. I worked, as soon as I came out, I was working. And I remember probably within, I think, the second year out of Guildhall, I did 13 weeks at Ronnie Scott's with different people.
Wow.
So I was lucky. I was just lucky.
Well, it's got to be a combination.
Yeah, but, you know,
being
it was...
Being able to do the job well.
Yes, I did prepare as well. I did some preparation. You know. But, it was... And I played with some good people, you know. Claire Martin. Did a lot of work with Claire Martin when I was younger.
Yeah.
And that... You know, that kind of led me to other things. Clark Tracy's band, who else? Tim Whitehead's band. Those were the sort of main bands that I was involved with at that time, although I did a lot of sort of sideman stuff, you know, for people like Don Weller and Alan Barnes and Art Thieman and, you know, that sort of scene. So straight ahead. Straight ahead, mate.
Straight ahead, but massively busy. And
busy.
I guess you
buzzer.
Thought it would carry on.
I thought that
in a similar vein.
I thought that was my life, Liz, you know. And it kind of has been for the last 30 years, actually.
Which is great. You've been teaching as well, haven't you? So you've been at Birmingham.
I've been teaching at Birmingham for 20 years now.
Have you, for 20 years?
I know, imagine that.
When you're working there and you're auditioning... bass players that you're auditioning? You don't.
Well, I do some drum auditions as well. But,
okay.
Yeah.
Do you think about your experience when you're auditioning people, or do you try and just separate yourself?
I don't think about my experience at all. No, no. I just try to take them as they come, you know.
Yeah.
Often they're auditioning on electric bass, so I suppose in that sense, okay. I suppose in that sense, yeah, I can see, well, they might be on electric bass now, but maybe they're going to want to try out some double bass at some point.
So you definitely look at potential as opposed to finding somebody that's kind of already got a lot of their stuff together.
Well, if someone's got a lot of their stuff together at that point,
yeah,
all well and good, you know, but yeah. I think I can sniff them out, you know, I can sniff out who's going to be a good bass player and who's not going to be.
That's good, because yeah. That's something I often think about with music college and with the intake and with the jazz scene as it is now, whether we're always able to give opportunity to people that might not have grown up with loads of private instrumental lessons. Well, I think that's the thing,
yeah.
People that can absolutely smash it, you know?
Well, a lot of those, the people that can smash it, to be honest, a lot of them go to London anyway, because they'll go to the Academy or they'll go to the Guildhall or Trinity. What we're finding now is that since we've moved into the new building, that we're probably getting more applicants and more suitable applicants. Yeah, like coming back to your original question, I try to look for potential, so...
Mm.
For example, James Osten, who was in the Young Jazz Musician of the Year finals last year, he came on electric bass. But, you know, you can tell if someone's got the ear for it and they've got the attitude for it, they'll have it on electric bass as much as double bass.
Yeah.
Then it's just a matter of transitioning from one to the other. And if they're willing to put the work in, then they'll be fine. That's what it comes down to at the end of the day. Time on the instrument.
Of course.
And their enthusiasm for wanting to do it.
And that's what music college gives you, doesn't it? It just gives you loads of time.
It does give you a load of time, but you have to manage that time properly, you know, and you have to, because there's a lot of academic stuff involved as well, and sometimes they moan about that.
Do you find you end up mentoring a lot as well as sort of teaching, as it were?
Yeah, I try to, yeah. With the academic stuff, I say, well, you're getting an academic degree, you know, you're getting a BMUS, so there's going to be an academic quotient. You've got to satisfy that as well. Because otherwise you could just go and get private lessons.
Of course,
practice, you know, which you'd probably end up at least as good, maybe even better as an instrumentalist if you did that.
But gives you the opportunity to play with people, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, but you're not part of that community. And I mean, I have utmost respect for those sort of people that just go and say, I'm going to go to New York and study and live there without any reason to go there other than the fact they're going to go there and do it and they want to do it. I think it's an incredibly brave thing to do.
Yeah.
But there is another route, and that's through the conservatoires. And I think also, you know, it probably comes down to parental pressure in a way as well.
Parental pressure, you mean to go to a music college?
Yeah, because if you just said you wanted to go and study in New York, I just want to be a jazz musician, right?
Yeah.
That's what I want to do. I want to be a jazz musician. And probably the most effective route to doing that, in a way, would just be to put loads of hours onto your instrument and get some good teachers in an informal setting. But that doesn't really sit comfortably with most parents' view of what their kids should be doing.
So what this does is it makes it more tangible.
And it gives them more of a structure, I suppose, and a security net, you know.
Yeah, it's definitely needed, isn't it, at 18?
And also, if you make the most of it, it can be very fruitful as well, because not only do you get instrumental lessons, but you get composition lessons and all that sort of stuff as well.
So yeah, jazz harmony lessons.
Yeah, jazz harmony lessons from dodgy bass players. Yeah, they pretend they know what they're talking about.
You've done loads of your own projects.
I've done a few things.
Quite a lot.
Yeah.
How many albums have you released? Five.
Let me think about this. Got that one, and then I got that one, and then I did that one, and I did that one.
How many Grammys?
I think I haven't got any Grammys. I think I've done five albums, yeah.
And each one has been with a different ensemble.
Each one has been with a different ensemble and a different direction.
Was that intended?
Yeah. All of them except the Mingus one, where I was asked to do that. It was kind of an interesting thing to do, but I don't think I'd do it again. I'm getting less and less into the idea of playing repertoire. And I'm getting less and less into the idea of playing American jazz,
right?
Even though I've been doing that sort of style of it for years and years.
Which project are you most proud of then?
Probably the improvisation thing. That's a long time ago now, though. That was just a very interesting thing to do.
Logistically,
that and an ambulance as well.
How hard was that? Because that was a mixture of Hungarian musicians and British musicians,
nightmare.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, logistically, it was just the cymbalom was the problem. Have you ever picked up a cymbal on? It's like trying to carry half a piano. They're really heavy, really, really heavy. And whoever's playing it needs to arrive at the gig 3 hours before everyone else is tuning it.
And was the person playing it transporting it from Hungary? Or was
Well, no, we borrowed one from the embassy.
Okay. Oh, really?
Yeah, and then we put one in the back, we put it in the back of the car. Me and Kalman, the cymbalon player, would head off
three hours early in the car.
And then the others would come in the van, you know, and it was...
How did you know these Hungarian musicians that you were using?
I went to Budapest and I shouted very loudly. Are there any folk musicians? No, it was all through contacts, really, through my friend Joel, who was playing guitar in that band. And people that I had heard on record, really. On record. On gramophone. On wax cylinders. It was a combination of folky things and jazzy things. It was probably like... It was a very esoteric project. But people liked it. You know, I still get people coming up to me now on gigs saying, I remember that band you did with those Hungarians. That was great. That was,
yeah.
You know. And it was very rewarding. And I'd like to do it again, but I'd like to do something. I'd like to do a stripped down version, smaller, more portable. And actually, nowadays, I think cymbalon players have worked out how they can do it with a smaller instrument now. So, you know, because a big concert cymbalon is huge. But they've got these smaller versions now that they can fly.
Things
with.
Have moved on.
Things have moved on, as they have in the double bass world as well. So it'll probably be easier now. Yeah, I need to get back on the saddle, the creative saddle.
You've got a new project, Albuquerque.
Albuquerque. I don't know how it's pronounced, actually. Albuquerque will do. Yes, it's a poisonous plant.
It's poisonous. Yes. I knew it was a plant, but it was poisonous.
Apparently it's a poisonous plant.
So why is it called that?
I don't know. We went through different names, but that was one that stuck for some reason.
Tell me about that. You played at the Jazz Festival recently, didn't
played
you?
Played at the LJF, the London Jazz Festival. Oh,
sorry.
Yeah. Now, this was something that Adrian, my mate Adrian, we're kind of back in touch with each other now after a long time. I thought that he might like to produce a record, and he did. So it's with Mark Edwards, who's it's mainly Mark Edwards and Ben Castle's kind of project. They kind of kick-started it, but now it's become, we're all kind of getting involved, you know.
It's one of those bands, Fliss,
that, you know, when you're playing with someone and it just feels really good, and it's like everyone's on the same page.
Yeah.
Aesthetically and sonically and kind of creatively.
It's special then.
Yeah, and it's like one of those things where you feel that you can take risks and it's interesting.
And are you all writing for that, or...?
I've done a bit of writing for it, but most of the stuff on the recording that we did were standards or adaptations of other things.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a Ellington tune on there, My Little Brown Book. There's a Coltrane thing on there, Equinox. There's a Brad Melder tune on there, one of mine. And Libera May. It's a classical piece, I can't think who wrote it now. Hold on, I've got a phone here. Let me just find out who wrote it.
And you're going to be recording or performing or both? Well, you've already recorded.
We've recorded.
Done that.
Yeah, but we need to kind of get the tour together now. I mean, this is the problem. This is the problem, you know. You need someone who's on the money business-wise. 4A. That's it, 4A. So there's a bit of 4A in there as well.
Great,
you know.
For the old classical buffs.
Yes, well, also, I mean, it's kind of like... It works really well, I think, with that genre of... It's kind of not a swing album. I think that's what it is, Fliss. I don't want to play swing anymore. I spent too long playing swing. I do love swing. Swing always wins, but I just want to try some different stuff, you know.
Well, why not, when you can mix with all these different people, all these musicians from everywhere? This sounds very, very exciting.
Yes.
Is there anything else coming up that you're very, even more excited about?
No.
Or as excited
Nothing.
About? Nothing. It's that. Are you planning to stay in Birmingham for a while at the conservatoire?
Yeah, I think so. I'm enjoying my teaching more and more. I'd rather teach now than go out and do gigs sometimes, which sounds weird, doesn't it?
It sounds weird to people that don't do it, but it's not that weird, I don't think.
Yeah, because...
It's nice to play nice gigs, isn't it?
Yeah, it is nice to play nice gigs. I think that's the thing. It's like those gigs that when you're schlepping around and it's a bit of a letdown musically.
And too often teaching is seen as a secondary thing that you do.
Well, I think I saw it as that for a long time, you know.
I think we all do, because we all grow up trying to be, I'm going to be a saxophone player, I'm going to be a bass player, and then I'll teach if I can't afford the rent. But actually...
Actually, as you get older, you know, you think, well, actually, I find this a bit more rewarding. When you get people who are enthusiastic.
It's lovely, and it's more social.
It is social, isn't it? Yeah, because you're communicating directly with somebody.
Yeah.
And also you're passing on your experience.
As you have been here.
As I have been passing it on.
Thank you very much, Arnie. Thank
you're welcome,
you for
Fliss.
Spending your time
That's
chatting.
That's very, very good. I hope it wasn't too boring.
And thank you for the time tea.
Oh, yes. Well, tea is, I think it's called the Radopsky tea. Oh no, that was a different one, wasn't it?
No, that's what we've had.
Is that the one?
That's the one. You can recommend it to the listeners.
Very nice, yes. Radopsky, Bulgarian Radopsky tea.
You can buy it only in Walthamstow.
Only in Walthamstow at...
On a cold January night.
The Bulgarian supermarket. This smells nice as well. There's a minty one here.
Right.
Wonder what this one's got in it.
Let's try that one now.
Let's try it.
So that concludes the podcast. Massive thanks to Arnie for taking the time to talk to me. He was delightful company, and I hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed talking to him. Arnie's website is www.arniesomerji.weebly.com. That's Weebly. If you go there, you'll find out more about him and the projects he's involved with. You can catch Albuca on tour in the UK this year, 2020. Confirmed dates that I know about are Bristol Jazz and Blues Festival on March 29th and Paul Lighthouse on the 3rd of April. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Journeys in Jazz podcast. Please subscribe now to keep up to date with future episodes. Find us on social media, #JourneysInJazz. I look forward to returning with another fabulous guest very soon.